Chapter 5 Homecoming. Those fortunate enough to have visited Munalinst in the decades preceding the Clone Wars often remarked that the planet had been blessed with the most beautiful skies in the galaxy. To maintain that pristine blue realm, to prevent it from being sullied by dropships, shuttles, or landing craft, the Munes had erected the most costly skyhook of its kind anywhere outside the core. As efficient as it was luxurious, the skyhook, known affectionately as the Financial Funnel, linked the orbital city of Highport with the planetary capital, Harnaden, which functioned as the nerve center of the intergalactic banking clan. While the stately tower seemed to speak to the Mune's high regard for aesthetics and ecology, its true purpose was to keep visitors from setting foot on Munalinst, thereby safeguarding the planet's wealth of resources and keeping secret the lavish lifestyles of those who had ascended to the top of the food chain. From its remote corner of the outer rim, Munalinst exerted its influence across all of known space and halfway to the galaxy's nearest satellite star cluster. Dating back to the founding of the Republic, the banking clan had funded governments, supported settlements, and bankrolled countless commerce guilds, trade corporations, and shipping cartels. In a very real sense, the IBC dictated the ebb and flow of wealth from the core to the outer rim. Scarcely a building was raised on Coruscant without the banking clan's approval. Scarcely a starship left the yards at Kuat or Bilbringi or Fondor without the IBC having brokered the deal. And scarcely an election occurred on Corellia or Kaminor without the Munes having been consulted. The Munes accomplished all these things with a meticulous serenity that belied the frenzied workings of their mathematical minds. Save for when it came to collecting on overdue debts, the Munes, on first acquaintance, appeared to be a stolid and lenient species, if somewhat arrogant, with an ascetic nature that was in full keeping with their willowy bodies and was reflected in the simple but harmonious architecture of their cities. As pale as the Munes themselves, Highport's space center incorporated the design elements they favored most. Domed interiors, arch-topped windows, fluted columns, and unadorned friezes and entablatures. Among these faux stone building blocks, large groups of Munes maneuvered and mingled with unhurried if single-minded purpose, maintaining a conversational clamor that struck some visitors as reminiscent of the spoken language of thinking machines. Attending them were droids of all variety, and guest workers from the nearby worlds of Beskane, Jamus, Intrala, and others. On any given day, a visitor might spy envoys from Yagai, Gravlex Med, or Kali, along with huts of the Drixo or Proga kin. But what one saw most, in overwhelming numbers, were members of the banking clan. Financiers, accountants, lawyers, dressed in their signatory palo fiduciary garb. Form-fitting green trousers and boots, round-collared green tunics, and flare-shouldered green cloaks. Some were accompanied by retinues of squat, dark-skinned, flat-nosed soldiers from the planet Iotra, sporting garish body armor and carrying ceremonial weapons. That day, cutting through the verdant sea like some predatory sea creature, came a wedge-shaped cluster of Munes, dressed in black cloaks and skullcaps, guarded by a contingent of tow-headed Ichani warriors, whose silver eyes darted vigilantly, and whose metallic bodysuits masked the translucency of their skin. At the leading edge of the wedge marched an elder Mune, with a whiskered chin and stooped shoulders, who was making directly for Highport's customs control station, where Higo Damask, as Plagueis was known to everyone but the late Darth Tenebris, and 114D were waiting, amid a contingent of security personnel.
"We came as soon as Highport Immigration notified us," Larsh Hill said. "If you had contacted us from deep space demolition, we could have sent a ship, rather than have you rely on Bas Cabra's specious hospitality."
"No one seems to believe that I'm capable of finding my own way home," Damask said.
Hill's long face wrinkled.
"I don't understand."
"It's not important that you do. Suffice it to say that your dispatching a ship would only have resulted in further delay."
Like Hill and his coterie of half a dozen, Damask's hairless head was encased in a tight-fitting bonnet, and the hem of his black coat swept the polished floor.
"You were expected days ago," Hill said with a note of exasperation.
"Events of an unforeseen nature prevented me from returning earlier."
"A successful journey, nevertheless, I assume?"
"You assume correctly."
Hill relaxed somewhat.
"We shouldn't tarry here any longer than necessary. Transport is waiting."
At Hill's gesture, the black-cloaked Munes began to angle toward the skyhook turbolifts, four of the silver-suited warriors falling into flank Damask and the droid, which walked behind him.
"You're limping," Hill said in hushed urgency. "Are you injured?"
"Healing," Damask said. "Make no further mention of it."
"We could postpone the gathering."
"No. It will take place as scheduled."
"But I'm relieved to hear that," Hill said, "since several of your guests are already in transit to Sojourn."
The group was halfway to the turbolifts when a faction of banking clan officials deliberately cut across their path, forcing them to halt. The faction's obvious leader, a Mune of middle age, separated himself from the rest and moved to the front.
"Magister Damask," he said, "what a surprise to encounter you here among the rabble."
Damask adopted a faint grin.
"Excluding yourself, of course, Chairman Toneth."
Toneth stiffened.
"We're simply passing through."
"As are we," Damask said, motioning to Hill and the rest.
"You've been traveling, Magister."
"A business trip, Chairman."
"Of course."
It was Toneth's turn to show a weak smile.
"But in that case, perhaps you haven't heard that the Senate is on the verge of creating additional free trade zones in the Outer Rim territories. Despite what I understand were considerable efforts on your part, to the contrary, the shipping cartels face the danger of being broken, and even if not, will certainly have to deal with fierce competition from startup companies. Both Core and Outer Rim worlds should benefit greatly from the arrangement, wouldn't you agree?"
Damask inclined his head in a bow of acknowledgement.
"I haven't heard, Magister. Whom can we thank for swaying the liberals to adopt the amendment?"
"Among others, the Jedi Order lobbied successfully."
"Then it must be for the best."
"One would think," Toneth said slowly, "save for the fact that in exchange, the Trade Federation will now enjoy full voting privileges in the Senate."
"Ah, well. Appeasements of one sort or another always figure into Senate affairs."
Toneth leaned slightly toward Damask.
"Thank you, however, for suggesting that we invest in Outer Rim and Trans-Perlemian shipping. The results provided a windfall."
"Where and when I can be of service, Chairman?"
Toneth straightened.
"Your clan father would be proud."
Damask looked Toneth in the eye.
"I take that as a compliment."
"How else would I mean it, Magister?"
When the banking clan members had moved off, and Damask's group was back in motion, Damask glanced at Hill.
"Someday we will topple the Toneths from their lofty perch."
Hill smiled with his eyes.
"I hope I'm alive to see that day. And just so you know, Higo, your father would be proud. Chairman Toneth's sarcasm notwithstanding."
"You would know better than most."
Having arrived at the skyhook turbolifts, Hill was motioning everyone but himself and Damask into a separate lift when Damask said,
"The droid will ride with us."
Hill appraised 114D as the three of them entered the turbolift.
"A new acquisition?"
"A door prize of sorts," Damask said. Hill didn't pursue it.
"You'll be going to your residence or to Abora?"
"Directly to the island. The droid will accompany me."
"I'll make the necessary arrangements."
Damask lowered his voice to ask,
"Are we secure in here?"
"Completely."
Damask turned to face the taller, elder Mune.
"Rugis Gnome is dead."
"The Bith?"
Hill said in astonishment.
"How? Where?"
"Of no relevance," Damask said, remembering.
"Eventually Gnome's estate will pass to us, but that won't be for some time to come, since it's unlikely that his body will ever be found." Hill didn't bother asking for details.
"We'll allow a standard year to pass. Then we'll petition the probate courts to render a decision, at the very least for whatever assets are contractually ours. You are the executor in any case, are you not?
Damask nodded. Ultimately, we'll be liquidating most of the estate. But there are several antiques of a curious sort I plan to retain. I'll prepare an inventory. In the meantime, I want you to familiarize yourself with a world called Baldemnik. Once you have, you're to acquire mining rights for the entire northeast peninsula of the principal landmass. Purchase as much property as you can, from the shoreline to the central highlands. I'll provide you with specific coordinates. Uncertainty tugged at Hill's strong features.
Are we venturing into the mining business now?
When the time is right. Use intermediaries who can't be traced to us. I suspect that you will have to go all the way to the top to secure what we need. The Indigenes will be troublesome to negotiate with, but I'm confident they can be persuaded. Bargain like you mean it. But in the end, spare no expense.
Baldemnik is that important?
A hunch, Damask said. Descending rapidly, the Skyhook turbolift pierced layers of pure white clouds, revealing a curved panorama of aquamarine ocean, pale brown plains, and evergreen forest. And directly below, the view that was said to take one's breath away, the city of Harnaden, studded with neoclassical structures as towering as the volcanic spires that ringed it, and home to 50 million Munes, living in an urbanscape that was an orderly masterpiece of art and design. To some, it was the antithesis of most planetary capitals, the anti-Coruscant, the anti-Dinan. What can we expect at the gathering? Damask asked, turning away from the view.
Gardula has requested an audience.
I'm not in the habit of sitting down with huts.
She asks your help in mediating a dispute.
With whom?
The Dasilogic clan.
Damask nodded knowingly. This has been brewing for some time. What else?
Representatives from Yinchor will be there.
Good. Holo transmissions have their limitations.
Members of the Trade Federation and the Grand Protectorate will also be attending.
Damask snorted. There's no pleasing any of them.
He grew pensive, then said,
There's another small matter we need to settle. Extend a personal invitation to the owners of Subtext Mining.
Hill rubbed his whiskered chin.
I can't recall having engaged in dealings with them. Does this have anything to do with Baldemnik?
Damask ignored the question. For a time, they advised Gnome. Make certain they understand that we operate in complete confidentiality.
If the Bith partnered with them, they must come highly recommended.
One would think. Damask turned his back to Hill to take in the view once more. But in fact, I don't see much future for them. Unlike so many worlds that had been surveyed and settled by species from the core, Munalinst had given rise to its own brand of sentience. Farmers and fisherfolk, the ancient Munes hadn't known how favored their planet was until interstellar travel had become commonplace, and precious metals the backbone of the galactic economy. Had those early millennia of expansion not been a time of peace, the Munes might have lost what they had to military might. But as it happened, they had resisted all attempts at exploitation and become masters of their fate. Still, what was an economic blessing eventually became a burden. Once the Munes understood the value of what they had previously taken for granted, they held on to their riches with a ferocious tenacity and developed an almost agoraphobic attachment to their homeworld. In the midst of Munalinst's shallow oceans, the same volcanic activity that had fertilized the vast plains belched new seabed and precious metals enough to fuel the growth of empires. Mountains heaped up through vents in the planetary crust were found to be repositories of extraordinary wealth. Lapped by warm waters teeming with shellfish, tube worms, and bioluminescent flora, such smokers, as they were known, became both the source and the financial vaults of Munalinst's most powerful and prosperous clans. More remote than some, Abora, which had been the province of the Damask clan for several generations,
was otherwise typical of the dormant smokers whose thickly forested conical peaks poked from the calm waters of the Western Sea. A maze of interconnected lava tubes ran deep into the mountain island. Waterfalls plunged from the sheer heights, and incense trees scented the salty air of the lowland valleys. Conveyed by speeder to Abora's North Tower complex, Plagueis escorted 114D on a tour of the corridors and cabins that constituted his place of sacrosanct solitude. Motioning to the many droids that were on hand to welcome the pair to Abora, Plagueis said,
"You will come to find yourself at home here, as I have."
"I'm certain I will, Magister Damask,"
114D said, its photoreceptors registering a dozen different types of droids in a single glance. Memo droids, G and K power droids, even a prototype Ubrickian surgical droid.
"In time we'll see to having your original appendages restored so that you can earn your keep."
"I look forward to it, Magister."
The tour began in the outermost rooms, which were appointed with furnishings and objects of art of the highest quality, gathered from all sectors of the galaxy. But Plagueis was neither as acquisitive as a Nymordian, nor as ostentatious as a Hutt. And so the ornamented chambers quickly gave way to data-gathering rooms crowded with audio-vid receivers and holonet projectors, and then to galleries filled to overflowing with ancient documents and tomes, recorded on media ranging from tree-trunk parchment through flimsoplast to storage crystal and holocron. The Munes were said to abhor literature, and to loathe keeping records of anything other than loan notices, actuarial tables, and legal writs, and yet Plagueis was guardian of one of the finest libraries to be found anywhere outside Aroa Sky or the Jedi Temple on Coruscant. Here, neatly arranged and catalogued and stored in climate-controlled cases, was a collection of treatises and commentaries accumulated over centuries by the Sith and their often unwitting agents. Ancient histories of the Rakata and the Bajoon, texts devoted to the followers of Palawa, the Chaetos Academy, and the Order of Dai Bendu, archives that had once belonged to House Malro, annals of the sorcerers of Tund and of Queen Amanoa of Onderon, biological studies of the Isalamiri and Vornskers of Mirkur, and of the Tauzin of Vart. Certain long-lived species like the Wookiees, Hutts, Falin, and Toydarians were afforded galleries of their own. Deeper in the mountain were laboratories where Plagueis' real work took place. Confined to cages, stasis fields, bioreactors, and bacta tanks were life forms brought to Munalinst from across the galaxy, many from the galaxy's most remote worlds. Some were creatures of instinct, and others were semi-sentient. Some were immediately recognizable to 114D, others resembled creatures concocted from borrowed parts. Some were newly birthed or hatched, and some looked as if they were being kept at death's door. More than a few were the subjects of ongoing experiments in what seemed to be vivisection or interbreeding, and others were clearly in suspended animation. 114D noted that many of the animals wore remotes that linked them to biometric monitoring machines, while others were in the direct care of specialist droids. Elsewhere in the hollow of the mountain were sealed enclosures warmed by artificial light, a swirl with mixtures of rarefied gases and luxuriant with flora. And deeper still were test centers crammed with complex machines and glass-fronted cooling units devoted to the storage of chemical compounds, alkaloids derived from both plants and animals, blood and tissue samples, and bodily organs from a host of species. Plagueis instructed 114D to wander about the galleries and laboratories on his own, and then report back to him. Hours later, the droid returned to say,
"I recognize that you are involved in research related to species durability and hybridization, but I must confess to being unfamiliar with many of the examples of fauna and flora you have amassed, and few of the arcane documents in your library. Is the data available for upload?"
"Some portion of it," Plagueis said. "The remainder will have to be scanned."
"Then the task will require standard years, Magister."
"I'm aware of that. While there is some urgency, we are in no rush."
"I understand, sir. Is there specific data you wish me to assimilate first?"
From the breast pocket of his cloak, Plagueis withdrew a storage crystal. "Start with this. It is a history of the Sith." 114D took a moment to search its memory.
I have multiple listings under that heading. One defines the Sith as an ancient sect devoted to the study of the Force, similar to the Jedi, but guided by different principles.
That's close enough for now, Plagueis said.
Magister Damask, if I may be so bold as to inquire, what is our eventual goal?
The goal is to extend my life indefinitely. To conquer death. The droid fixed Plagueis in its photoreceptors.
I have access to data on alleged elixirs of life and fountains of youth, Magister. But all living things ultimately die, do they not?
At present, 114D. The droid thought harder about it.
I have experience in organ replacement surgery, telomere genotherapy, and carbonite suspension, but nothing beyond that.
Plagueis' smooth upper lip curled. Then you've merely scratched the surface. With 114D deep in processing mode, Plagueis withdrew a vial of his own blood and subjected it to analysis. Despite the recent amplification of his powers, he sensed that his midichlorian count had not increased since the events on Baldemnik, and the analysis of the blood sample confirmed his suspicions. Research had long ago established that blood transfusions from force-sensitive individuals did not confer force powers to recipients. Though blood with high midichlorian count could grant temporary strength and resiliency, experiments in absolute transfusion had gone horribly awry for recipients, suggesting to some that the force exacted a toll on those who attempted to tamper with it. An individual's midichlorians seemed to know to whom they belonged and become unresponsive outside their dedicated vessel. While midichlorians appeared to resist manipulation of a sort that might imperil the balance of the force, they remained passive, even compliant, in the case of a weak-willed being manipulated by one who was strong in the force. Perhaps that explained why it was often easier to call on the force to heal someone other than oneself. Extending life, then, could hinge on something as simple as being able to induce midichlorians to create new cells, to subdivide at will, increasing their numbers into the tens of thousands to heal or replace damaged, aging, or metastatic cells. Midichlorians had to be compelled to serve the needs of the body, to bestow strength when needed, to overcome physical insult, or prevent cells from reaching senescence. If one accepted the tales handed down in accounts and holocrons, the ancient Sith had known how to accomplish this. But had Sith like Naga Sadao and Exar Kun genuinely been more powerful? Or had they benefited from the fact that the dark side had been more prominent in those bygone eras? Some commentators claimed that the ability to survive death had been limited to those with a talent for sorcery and alchemy, and that the use of such practices actually predated the arrival of the Dark Jedi exiles on Korriban. But sorcery had been employed less to extend life than to create illusions, fashion beasts, and resurrect the dead. Powerful adepts were said to have been able to saturate the atmosphere of planets with dark side energy, compel stars to explode or induce paralysis in crowds, as Exar Kun apparently did to select members of the Republic Senate. Other adepts used sorcery merely as a means to better understand ancient Sith spells and sigils. Darth Bane had referred to sorcery as one of the purest expressions of the dark side of the Force, and yet he hadn't been able to harness those energies with near the skill as had his one-time apprentice, Zana. Bane's disciples, however, believed that he had experimented with a technique of even greater significance, that of essence transfer, which he had learned after acquiring and plundering the holocron of Darth Undedu, and which involved the relocation of an individual's consciousness into another body, or in some cases, a talisman, temple, or sarcophagus. Thus had the most powerful of the ancient Sith lords survived death to haunt and harass those who would infiltrate their tombs. But none of this amounted to corporeal survival. Plagueis had no interest in being a lingering disembodied presence trapped between worlds and powerless to affect the material realm except through the actions of weak-minded beings he could goad, coax, or will into action. Nor did he seek to shunt his mind into the body of another, whether an apprentice, as Bane was thought to have attempted, or some vat-grown clone. Nothing less than the immortality of his body and mind would suffice. Everlasting life. Sadly, he could glean only so much from the texts, crystals, and holocrons stored in the library. Crucial knowledge had been lost during the brief mastery of Darth Gravid, and many of the most important elements of Sith training since had been passed from masters to apprentices in sessions that had been left unrecorded. More to the point, Darth Tenebris had had very little to say regarding death. Alone in one of the test centers, surrounded by his experiments, these things Plagueis could say he loved. The enormity of what had occurred on Baldemnik suddenly rose up before him like a monolith of immeasurable proportions. For the first time, he could feel the force of the dark side not as a mere supporting wind fluffing the sails of a pleasure boat, but as a hurricane eager to loose a storm of destruction on the crumbling Republic and the indolent Jedi Order. A scouring storm that would lay waste to everything antiquated and corrupt, and pave the way for a new order in which the Sith would be returned to their rightful place as the stewards of the galaxy, and before whom all the diverse species would bow, not only in obeisance and fear, but in gratitude for having been drawn back from the brink. The task before him was at once invigorating and daunting, and in the eye of that cycloning storm he could hear the faraway voices of all those who had laid the groundwork of the Sith's imperative, the Grand Plan, those who had enlivened the hurricane with their breath and lives. Darth's Bane and Zanna, and on down through the generations that had included Cognus, Vectivus, Ramage, and Tenebris. 100 years earlier, Tenebris's Twi'lek master had opened a small rend in the fabric of the Force, allowing the dark side to be felt by the Jedi Order for the first time in more than 800 years. That had been the inauguration, the commencement of the revenge of the Sith. And now the time had come to enlarge that rend into a gaping hole, a gaping wound, into which the Republic and the Jedi Order would, to their own hazard, be drawn.